CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 115 with Dr. Deepak Magur. Great surgeries in your mind, not only your hands. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I got a very special guest, especially for young ophthalmologists who really want to maximize their surgical skills and learn a lot. Now, I'm sure you've seen his videos because I'm a fan of his videos. That's Dr. Deepak Magur. Welcome, my friend.
Hi, great to be here on your show, Uday. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Now, you make a lot of amazing YouTube videos, which I really, even in my late stage of my career, have learned a lot from. How did you get started making YouTube videos?
Well, you know, I just was fascinated about teaching, and I enjoy teaching, and internet just gave me a great opportunity. That's all. So I'm in private practice. I'm not in any teaching college or anything. I'm just passionate about recording my surgeries, seeing them. And maybe I thought they'd help younger colleagues who don't have to go through the grind, which I did. And I felt that internet was a great boon. So I just started it maybe 8 years back.
Yeah, the videos are fantastic. We'll put a link down below to his YouTube channel. And you've got, I think, my 500 videos and coming on 30 million views. So really grown in popularity quite a bit.
Yeah. It's thankfully people are liking what I do. So good to know that.
Well, the amazing part is that sometimes, you know, we have so much that we can teach our colleagues, and ophthalmology is beautiful because it's a very visual field. I mean, we learn by seeing the video. And I also love your very simple explanations. You break it down. And my most favorite of your videos are the ones where you show common mistakes.
Yeah, the thing is, you know, the reason why I thought of, you know, you getting this channel in was, in most of the meetings, we all know what is to be done. They all show what is to be done. But how is to be done, that is one link which is missing in all our conferences and meetings. Because major time, it is assumed that they know all these small tricks. It's assumption that, you know, the younger colleagues will also know the small tricks, or we would have forgotten how we learned them. So that is what, you know, this little hand-holding is required for the budding surgeon. And the missing link is how it is to be done, right? What is to be done? What is to be done, everybody knows. Like, so for example, CTR, how do you put a CTR in? But how it is to be done for the first few cases, that little bit of hand-holding really helps a lot for the younger colleagues. And the idea is to, you know, shorten the learning curve. I don't want the people to go through the, a small tip would save them 6 years of their lives. For me, many times it has taken, you know, when I started my career, there was no internet, there's no YouTube. We used to learn only during the annual conferences. So every year, it used to be 365 days for us to learn one new tip. Okay, then you have to wait another 365 days to learn one more new tip. So that has changed. The modern generation is blessed. The only thing, if they have the passion and the dedication, they can get everything. So the idea is to shorten the learning curve. So I believe, you know, if you can, the senior colleagues can share these little secrets, the learning curve of our younger colleagues can be shortened by years.
Right. In fact, there's been a big shift here. You're right about this. I recently was here at the ASCRS meeting in Los Angeles, and attendance seemed pretty low. I think people now, the old way 20 years ago was, or even 10 years ago, was you'd wait to the meeting every year and you'd go there and you'd learn as much as you can at those meetings. And then you'd come back a year later and you learn in such small steps because you have to wait a year at a time.
Yes, absolutely. No, that has changed. So you have, even if the meetings are there, you'll hardly have any attendance in the halls. The attendance in the halls itself is less.
Yeah, in fact, I think that's really true. It's changed a lot. We used to have, obviously, we still have Bobby Ocean, one of my idols. Yeah. And he would, every quarter, so every 3 months, he'd come out with the video journal, which is super amazing. I mean, I finished my training in the year 2000. So back then, 1990, was when I was a resident, to find one of his VHS tapes and watch it, just so many times just to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's fair to conclude that the present generation are a blessed lot. They really are blessed a lot. They have knowledge at the fingertips. They just click and they have the tips flowing in through them. They don't have to wait for an year to get one small tip.
Right. In fact, so when I, my best of Cataract Coach session at the ASCRS, which we'll feature here on Cataract Coach in the coming month or two, I wanted to make it something you couldn't get online. So I had audience questions, 30 questions, so you could play along as we're doing it. And then on top of that, I had a couple of great panelists who we really focused on the interaction between, because that you don't get as much if you're watching a 5-minute video online. So I tried to make it a little different, because I thought otherwise, just stay home and watch the video online.
Yeah. That's true. That's true.
But yeah, I think for most people now it's changed. The purpose of your big annual meeting is mostly to catch up with colleagues, maybe to see some new equipment hands-on so you can evaluate it.
Yeah,
and maybe doing a little bit in the lecture halls, but honestly, it's what you said. You've got to have your mobile phone and you have to have a dedication to learn every day.
Absolutely, yeah. See, I think the what you do with the knowledge which is available, that will determine the future of the younger colleagues. The knowledge is there, but the ultimate thing is fire in the belly. Do you have it in you to make it count? That's going to decide. Initially, the knowledge was available in very sparse quantity, and it used to be a long time to get one. But nowadays, things are fast. Everything is changing so fast, and you have got the information available with you at your fingertips. What you do with that information is going to decide your future.
Right. You have to have the drive to learn it. I mean, the danger, some people, you see this in the community, they learn some techniques in residency, and then for the rest of their career, they just do those old techniques. They don't keep learning.
That's true. That's true. I think that's extremely important. And in this current generation era where things are changing so fast, things which we learned or understood maybe 5 years back would be redundant in the next 5 years. So you have to be up to date, and you have to be, you know, learn new skills as well.
Now, a common question I get, I travel a lot to give lectures, and some people are fortunate. They may be in a country or a residency program where they get to do a lot of surgery. And others, even particularly in certain parts of Europe, they'll do a 4 or 5 years ophthalmology training and have very few surgeries. How can that person continue to learn?
Yeah.
They feel a little intimidated.
That's very true, and it's a realistic problem. But on the same side, you know, you need to have a certain number of cases, I believe. You know, you just can't, just by doing few 10 surgeries, you just can't, you know, pick up the necessary skills. You need to have a dedicated number, a few surgeries. At the same time, I would also tell that, you know, beyond a certain time, beyond a certain numbers, it won't matter. Okay? If you keep doing the same mistakes again and again, no matter how many thousand surgeries you do, you're still not going to learn. But if you're very focused and maybe do maybe a few hundred surgeries in a very critical way, analytical way, you got it. But at least few hundreds you need to have. You just can't do it without intense numbers. You need to have the feel.
Well, so you make a good point here. It's not just doing the cases. It's learning from every single case.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's what I tell all my junior colleagues. You know, forget about the good cases. Keep the cases which you have made mistakes or complications closest to your heart. Never forget those cases. In fact, I would recommend them to remember the patient's name as well until you die. Because the cases where we do mistakes, that's the way we learn. Not the ones which have gone become good, you know. Not the cases which have turned out to be all right. So never forget the cases where you've done a mistake and you have had a complication. Because those are the ones which are going to teach you, not the good ones. So if you're okay to forget the good ones, always keep the ones which you have messed up very close to the heart. In fact, I tell you, don't even forget the patient's name.
Right. Because the difference between a mistake and a lesson is you learn from the lesson. So let it be a lesson that you had this complication.
Absolutely. So every mistake you should make an opportunity to learn. Okay. Just don't. Some people have a habit of just forgetting the mistake, brush it under the carpet and act as if all is good. But that is not to be done. Okay. Just because that's their outlook is like, you know, had a bad day, forget it. Just want to go over, but make this an opportunity to learn and never try to repeat the same mistakes. It can still happen, but try to minimize it as much as possible. So never brush the mistake under the carpet.
For sure. I try to be a smart surgeon, meaning I want to learn from my mistakes. But I think the next level and beyond is you can be really wise, learn from the mistakes of others. That's why
absolutely
my favorite is like your complication videos.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. So you don't have to be as dumb as us, where we had to do the mistakes and learn from our own. So learn from other people's mistake because you're the smarter ones.
Right. Yeah, and I think the young generation really has taken that to heart. I'm super impressed with the way that the young surgeons operate. It's on another level. They really have access to this video has been such a huge improvement for them.
Absolutely. Because we learned a lot by reading. Okay, we used to read a lot and then learn. But now actually they see the maneuvers, how it is being done. And it is, we have to imagine, we have to read, and we have to imagine how it is to be done. But nowadays, we are seeing with some exceptional quality also. The quality of the videos are so good nowadays, so that the understanding and imagination is much more easier for these newer colleagues.
Right. In fact, I haven't bought an ophthalmology book in years.
That's true. That's same here with me.
And if the ASCS is one of the major ophthalmic book publishers, actually just closed. This year they decided that they're not doing any more books. It's just finished.
Yeah. That's true.
But you're right. We would look at the books and they'd be pictures and you try to imagine the surgery.
Yeah.
And then maybe 10 years ago, then the new innovation was the books would come with a DVD.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now it's just like, we'll just learn it online. Everything's there.
Everything is there. Yeah, it's true. So true.
But I think, yeah, for me, for sure, like when people send videos for cataract coach, I get about 50 videos sent to me a week.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot. I go through every one of them. But the ones I don't want is, okay, you did a beautiful 3-minute surgery. Very nice. But that's not what I want to show the world. Show me a complication and how you recovered from it. Teach me a lesson. Don't show me how amazing you are. I know you're amazing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. See, because we don't want other people to go through the same mistakes which we have done. That's the reason why we should show the mistakes, so that, you know, eventually the end beneficiaries are patients world over. They're going to get the best of the care. So they don't have to, you don't have to cause the complications, because if somebody has done it, other person can learn from it how not to do it. And even if it is done, how to manage it without doing any harm to the patient. So eventually the end point is, end goal is, better care for our patients world over.
Well, no, for sure. Absolutely for sure. And yeah, again, the best learning, at least for me, is a complication case. In fact, I post on every time I have a complication, I'm for sure posting that video up online.
Sure, sure, sure.
So, like, let me learn from it. Absolutely. And then let me also ask the audience. I had a case that I showed where I put a CTR in and I just didn't know exactly what happened or where the CTR went, and the caps looked all wrinkled. I ended up taking it out and I watched the video 20 times. I couldn't figure it out. So I put it on Cataract Coach, and I got the opinion of all the thousands of viewers. And it was amazing that no one could agree, but at least we put it out there. We learned as a group. We have the group mind.
Very true, very true. Absolutely right.
Now, one of the challenges, I think, is, as you were saying earlier, learning a new technique. So in the USA, unfortunately, surgeons are really not taught how to do MSICS. So the manual small incision cataract surgery. They basically start right away with phaco. In fact, sometimes their residents don't even learn how to make a scleral tunnel. They're just doing clear corneal phaco right away. And how would you advise an American surgeon, let's say, mid-career, 50 years old, who hasn't done MSICS before? How do you learn it?
Actually, Uday, it's not so difficult. Frankly speaking, for an accomplished phaco surgeon like this, it is not so difficult. It's just find, you know, give yourself some time, prepare yourself, watch a lot, read a lot, and understand the feel of this thing, and then you're good to go. The challenge really is not with the 50-year-olds, but the newer surgeons, okay? Right. Because 50-year-old surgeons at least know how to do an ECC, okay? They know how to do an ECC. They know how to suture. They're surgically much more well-equipped, experienced to learn this. For a 50-year-old surgeon, learning SICS, who's an accomplished phaco surgeon, is not a big deal. Mm. You just learn, watch a few videos and learn about it, and then you're good to go. Maybe for one or two cases, you'll have difficulty creating a tunnel. Otherwise, it's fine. But my concern is for the newbies who directly want to do a clear corneal incision, because they don't know how to come out if they're stuck in a mess. Okay, right. If they have a complication, they don't know how to. They don't know how to do ECC. They don't know how to do MSICS. They don't know how to convert. Like, you know, if there is some complication where you're forced to abort phaco emulsification, they're just in situation they close and call for help. So they're not able to manage it on their own. So thankfully, in my country, the training is like this. First, you do SICS, and then only you do phaco. In most institutions, it's like that. And I really feel that every cataract surgeon in the world should be very proficient in MSICS, and if not ECC, at least they should be very proficient. It's not like, you know, you just know phaco emulsification. That's not good enough, because you want to come out of a tricky situation without causing much damage to the eye when you're stuck in, you know, bad situations. So that's the reason why I believe that every cataract surgeon the world over should be proficient enough in the current era manual SICS. There's no excuse for that. There's no excuse for that.
In fact, I use it even in Beverly Hills, California. I use MSICS at least once or twice a month.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a lifesaver.
Yeah, absolutely. See, next day when you have a clear corneas on those very dark cataracts, black or hard cataract, patient doesn't want much. He's very happy. And in fact, you're very skillful. You can match the results of the FICO. So in this era, I think you should be the challenge is really to teach the newer colleagues, like, you know, especially in European countries and in US, where the focus is directly on phacoemulsification.
Right.
For an experienced surgeon, no, I don't think it's a big deal. Most people can learn SICS in just maybe 10 cases. You'll be good to go because you already have the experience of microsurgery. Challenges for the newbies.
The 26-year-old.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? Learning surgery.
Yeah.
But I think that's important. The training has changed. In the US, back when I did my residency 25 years ago, we had to do 10 ECCE surgeries first.
Okay.
Before doing even one FACO. And then for the FACOs, we had to do, I don't know, a couple dozen of them with scleral tunnels first.
Okay.
Before moving to a corneal incision.
Okay. So that actually, I think that's the right way. I feel it's the right way because I feel learning to suture with a tenon nylon suture, it's the greatest skill one can have. To improve your dexterity, to improve your motor skills, suturing with tenon nylon, it is the best way to enhance your dexterity. That is gone now. It's like directly you're doing with the FICO probe. It's like playing a video game now directly. So you lost the art of suturing. And I feel that's the most finest part of a microsurgery. It's really going to help you to, you know, fine-tune your hand movements and improve your dexterity. Unfortunately, suturing is a lost art. Nowadays, we don't see. And the reason why the SSRG, because they should do the 10 or 20 ECCs. They're forced to do five sutures per case. So imagine you're breaking the suture every time, going in and again putting it. Remember the first few sutures, they'll break 100 times and then you have to go back and put it. And that is the best way to improve your dexterity. That's what I feel. And that is, we are losing it now.
In fact, I said the same thing. Here, when I was professor at UCLA, I retired a couple years ago, but we had the fancy $250,000 surgical simulator. And I said, that's very good and all. But I said, my advice is, be able to do what I called my 10-10-10 rule. Okay. 10 sutures of 10 on, yes. 10 on nylon in 10 minutes.
Absolutely. The same thing I believe. If you can improve on that thing, that is nothing like that. Time your sutures every day. And that's the best way to improve your dexterity and your microsurgical skills. Period.
Oh, I think absolutely. I think, and it took most residents, it took them a few hundred practice sutures to be able to do 10 sutures, 10 minutes, 10 on nylon.
Absolutely. You're right. It takes a lot of time. It really is skillful. Really skillful. Never undermine the ECC surgeons. I have got great respect for them. Because they just finished the entire case in 10 minutes. Imagine suturing everything. Let's do this. And amazing it was.
Right. No, for sure. And then the beauty of the suturing is you can practice just under the microscope with a tomato or a grape. Just cut it and suture it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. That's it you should do. So in our practice, at least the first thing which we do is ask them to put at least 100 sutures before even they start doing SICS. So 100 sutures they should show us, and then the next transition starts. So it's an important skill.
No, I think that's very true. Now, in learning some of these more complicated FACO techniques, I like your basics. Do you recommend going through, for nucleus division, start with divide and conquer, then do stop and chop, then horizontal chop? What's your progression to teach someone?
Yeah, I tried direct chop as well to few candidates, but it didn't work. So usually I feel the first is sculpting, you know, you create a trench. So the first few cases, always the divide and conquer, four quadrant technique I do, and then stop and chop, and then direct chop. So I tried in few candidates direct chop, but the left hand, the non-dominant hand coordination is a challenge for most beginners. So going in for trenching first, and then stop and chop, and then chop. This is the transition which I follow.
Do you have any other advice for young surgeons who are starting off to improve their non-dominant hand dexterity? I would tell my residents, use your non-dominant hand to eat food, shave as much as you can with the non-dominant hand.
Yeah, apart from that, what we insist is start writing with your non-dominant hand.
Oh, wow.
So the end point is you should not be able to distinguish the handwriting, which is right and which is the left eye. If you reach that stage, that is the end point. So the non-dominant handwriting should be as similar as that is your dominant hand. So that is your end point.
Wow. Well, I can do okay with that. But okay. The reason is when I was a kid, I used to do left-handed at school.
Oh, okay.
Then I came home and my parents made me switch.
Okay.
They were very strict.
Yeah, you are one of the unique people. I think you already have half of your childhood with the non-dominant hand, and then you switched over to the dominant hand.
Yeah, my parents were strict. When I did homework at home, they used to make me sit on my left hand
okay.
and only use the right hand. But then I would go to school and I would just do it left-handed because it's faster.
Okay. So you are a special one. You're a special one. I think God made you to do fake. You know you're going to be a phaco surgeon, so he just did it like this for you people.
How did you get involved or interested in ophthalmology as opposed to some other medical subspecialty?
Yeah, no, it was like my dad is an ophthalmologist.
Okay.
So it was just like that. No, there's nothing. I didn't have any special interest or anything. It's just like my dad has had a practice. So I just had the option of seeing him day in and day out in doing ophthalmology work. So that's how I got into it.
I think a lot of ophthalmologists have that, where they have family members who are in ophthalmology, because you see that it's like, wow, that's a pretty good life, and you're happy, and your patients are happy, and it's like, it's one of the very few, very happy fields in medicine.
That's true. You can't have a happier patient who has a disease the next day. No disease. Even a person gets a cold, it'll take common cold. It takes 4 or 5 days for him to get better, but cataract, he can see well the next few hours. Nothing like that. We are blessed.
Now, you do other anterior segment surgeries as well. I've seen you have some beautiful glaucoma videos too.
Yeah. I'm doing cataract and glaucoma. These are two specialties.
So where does it come into play for a young surgeon? Now, most surgeons are learning certainly how to do MIGS procedures, minimally invasive glaucoma surgery during cataract surgery. But a lot of the younger surgeons aren't really learning how to do tubes and trabs. Should they be picking this up as well or doing a separate glaucoma training after?
Well, I think in India, definitely we have a glaucoma fellowship separately in India. We have that. But because the cases are far, we have got a lot of cases. So an accomplished phaco surgeon can definitely learn the glaucoma surgery part on his own as well. And especially the mixed part doesn't seem to be very, it seems to be, you know, for accomplished surgeon can very well learn it quite quickly. Sure. But for the tubes and the traps, definitely exposure to a few cases would be better. But in India, we do have a specialized glaucoma fellowships as well. But an accomplished phaco surgeon can definitely learn it in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, when I was teaching my residents at our big kind of charity hospital here, we had a lot of neovascular glaucoma.
Okay.
From vascular occlusion, also bad proliferative diabetic retinopathy. And so those patients who had the bad neovascular glaucoma, we did, you know, setons, tubes, and usually Ahmed valves.
Okay.
And so even it was so common, we did it with the junior residents. We taught them. We taught every junior resident to do these.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
And so I think it's definitely in your armamentarium. I think probably the challenge though is, it's not just doing the surgery, but it's the follow up.
Absolutely. So a glaucoma patient is there for you for lifetime. So you need to be. So that's it. That's the challenge.
Right. We've had a lot of videos recently on Cataract Coach of how he managing late stage things like when you know. Ring of steel form around for drainage device or how to manage the pressure spikes post-op. And so there's I think there's a lot more nuance there. And you're right. If you really want to do these cases, maybe it'd behoove you to do a dedicated fellowship for it.
Absolutely.
Now, there are some students who say, I just can't figure out how to do phaco chop. I watch the videos. I'm just sticking with divide and conquer. Is that okay?
It's okay, but as a surgeon, I think it's better. It's always good to evolve and challenge yourself and keep growing, you know. It's okay. It's perfectly fine to do divide and conquer. Not an issue at all. You can give equally good results by doing a divide and conquer for point technique as well. But there's no harm in that. There's no shame in that, frankly speaking. There's no shame in that. But for me personally, I think as a surgeon, I need to evolve. I need to grow. I need to learn new techniques. And maybe in certain situations, the chop is going to be definitely be better than the divide and conquer. There are a few situations where I would prefer to do a direct chop technique. So I would love to learn as many new techniques as possible and be well equipped.
Yeah, it makes sense to have as many different tools in the toolbox and then you can tailor it to the specific patient.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I normally am a chop surgeon as well, but I had a patient recently with a very shallow AC, short axial length eye, very thick nucleus, like 5 millimeter anterior to posterior. So I just did stop and chop, and I made the groove double wide to even more debulk it. So now each half of the nucleus wasn't 50%, it was like 40, because I took out so much of a groove. And I thought that worked really well in that case. But if I just done just direct chop, it would have been more challenging.
Absolutely. Things, you know, it's better to be, you know, having more tools in your toolkit. Be well-versed with all the techniques.
No, for sure. So what's your typical technique then, your go-to for most of the patients? Like in your clinic?
Yeah. For me, more direct chop is the most direct vertical chop. I do the vertical chop, not the horizontal chop for most techniques. In few cases where the extremely soft cataract or extremely hard cataract, maybe I'll change it to stop and chop or the four quadrant technique.
Yeah, I guess it also depends on your patient population. I think for me, in my clinic, I'd say 80% of the patients have a relatively soft nucleus.
Okay.
And only 20% have, you know, an increased amount of nuclear density, but that's probably because of my location.
Absolutely. So in my location, it's totally a rural practice for me in India, rural practice. It's exactly opposite of what your percentage is. So mine would be 80% dense cataract and 20% soft cataract.
Wow. So like in my population, maybe 1 or 2% of the patients have a white cataract. What about for you?
In my practice, at least 30% of 30-40% is totally white cataract. So 30%. 35% is white cataract, totally white. And 1 or 2% of my patients will still be having phacomorphic glaucoma, phacolytic glaucoma, 2% of my patients.
Wow, like Morganian cataract, yeah, that far ahead.
Yeah, yeah. With lens-induced glaucomas, Morganian phacolytic glaucomas or hypermature phacomorphic glaucomas, swollen lens causing a glaucoma. So 1 to 2% are there. With every month, we'll get at least 3-4 cases, such cases will be there for me.
Well, that's, so again, that just depends on your location. Because me, a Morganian cataract or that kind of hypermature lens is 1 in 1,000.
Okay. So that's quite common here. So in India also, it's variable. Like if you're practicing in a metro city, like in Bangalore or Mumbai, maybe it will not be so bad. But my practice is predominantly in the rural part of the India. So here we get these more of delayed cataracts,
And then what percent of the patients in your clinic will do phaco versus M6?
Maybe 95-98% we do phaco only. Only 2% would be SICs in my clinic.
Oh, fantastic here. Do you have any, so you have obviously great expertise in these cases. What is your favorite way to minimize the capsule risk in a patient with an intumescent white cataract to prevent Argentinian flag sign?
Yeah.
What is your preferred technique?
Yeah, it has been evolving over a period of time. Initially, I used to do a double rexus, make a small rexus, initially debulk the capsular bag and then do a bigger rexus. But of late, I realized that if you have a softer eye, so nowadays what I do, I used to do all these cases in topical anesthesia before. Now I'm giving a block and a massage, which makes the eye soft. And then I do a rexus, which is directly 5 millimeter. I don't do a two-stage rexus now. So I've gotten over it now.
So you do retrobulbar block, and then you're doing like massage. What, like a Honan balloon massage?
Yeah, no, we do with the digital. We just use two fingers to just press down, intermittent pressure, wait for 5 minutes, that's all. 5 to 7 minutes.
How much pressure and how long do you apply pressure for?
So we count up to 10 seconds, then leave it for 10 seconds, and again, apply for maybe 5 to 10 seconds and leave it. This is the intermittent pressure. So it's not a constant pressure. Apply it for 10 seconds, count up to maybe 10, leave it for 10 seconds, again count. Just keep it for 5 minutes, that's what we do, and then we operate. And nowadays, I don't even do your two-stage rexus as well. Just use the sodium hyaluronate. The trick here is to have a soft eye. So the other ways to do is, you know, you can use IV mannitol as well, but that also stopped now. So IV mannitol, I'm going to use only when the antechamber depth is less than 2 millimeter, okay? Anything less than 2 millimeter, then only I'm going to use IV mannitol. Otherwise, anything less than 2.5, I'm going to give a block and then massage. And that is what is going to help me. So the antechamber depth, the whatever it is, that's going to decide my decision making. If it is less than 2 millimeter, the lens is so much swollen that the chamber is less than 2 millimeter. In that case, I'll give an IV mannitol. Otherwise, 2.4 or less, it would be just the block and massage. That would be fine. If in the mature cataracts, so I got a chamber depth of more than 2.5, I would do under regular topical anesthesia and intracamera anesthesia. That would be fine.
Wow, that's very interesting. Yeah, for the young dogs who may not know, In the old days of cataract surgery, the surgeon used to use something called a Honan balloon, H-O-N-A-N.
Yeah.
So this is a device that you basically put over the eye and around around the head, and then there was like an air pump bulb, like in a blood pressure cuff.
Yeah.
You'd inflate and it would apply pressure right on top of the eye, and it really softened the eye quite a bit.
Yes. So if you have access to that balloon with you, use it, no problem at all. If you don't have, just use the pressure, intermittent pressure. That's what we used to do.
I would love to see a video of this. If you have a video, send it. We'll put on Cataract Coach and link it back to your videos too.
Sure.
I think that's, I mean, it's impressive because you do obviously many more white cataracts than I do.
Sure.
And yet you've found that you can do this and not have a risk of the Argentinian flag. You don't have to do all the special maneuvers.
Yeah, no. It has really come down significantly. The trick is a soft eye. You should have a soft eye. What happens when you're doing under, even when the patient is under topical anesthesia, there are two disadvantages. Even the micro movements which a patient is doing, the extraocular muscles are squeezing the eyeball and there's always a positive pressure which is building up. No. So no matter what heavy viscoelastic, that positive pressure is going to ensure that the rexus is a little bit uncontrolled. If the eyeball is soft and the total akinesis is there, then it is very, very simple. So you don't get to have this Argentinian flag sign at all. The trick is the soft eye. Soft eye is the trick. So
that's amazing.
IV mannitol is a good thing, but you know, it is not tolerated by many of the elderly patients because they have to go to the washroom a lot and all those things. So it is the last resort. Okay, it's the second last resort in very, very tight gloves where you have an acute angle closure glaucoma with a swollen lens and all those things. There's situations where you have the massage block as well as the IV mannitol. Otherwise, just the block and the massage is going to help you. So trick
and then the larger bulb or block, though, not too much. You don't want to put 10 cc's of in the orbit.
You can just use 2 ml for retrobulbar block. Or if you're not good at retrobulbar block, maybe 4 ml in peribulbar block. Either way, either thing would do. Okay. Retrobulbar block, only 2 ml. Or 4 ml of peribulbar block, give a massage, and then go ahead.
That's an important rule. Because remember, like the volume of the orbits may be 30 cc's. And if you put a big 10 cc retrobulbar, now you have a lot of posterior pressure. You're gonna shoot yourself in the foot.
No. Yeah, absolutely. So retrobulbar, you can't put anything more than 2. It's not advisable to put anything more than 2 ml in retrobulbar. Peribulbar would be 4.
What's that fantastic technique? I'd love to see it. Now give me some more good surgical pearls here. let's talk about some other scenarios that are challenging. Like, what's your preferred in a small pupil case? Not tiny, but let's say the patient has like a 3-4 millimeter pupil. What are you going to do here?
Initially, I think the first thing which I would like to do is, try the intracamera dilating agent.
Okay.
If it, like, we have the mixture of phenylephrine and tropicamide and the xylocaine, which we have in our country. Inject maybe just 0.3 cc and see if it dilates well. Then it's all, and then you have a second option would be to use heavy viscoelastic, viscomidriasis also works. Yeah. But in rigid pupils, like pseudoexfoliation and all, if it doesn't help in these, none of the intracamera agents are going to help you out. In those situations, we have to use a pupil expansion device. I would not, my threshold is quite low. I would not hesitate to go ahead and use a pupil expansion device.
Right, why suffer, right?
Yeah, why suffer?
You just put it in for pupil. So you tend to use one of these rings, right? Like the BX ring or something?
Yeah. In India, because BX ring is more affordable for us, so that's the reason we use it. Malugin is a little bit expensive for us, so that's the reason why BX is the one which we use most often. And there are a couple of other rings as well, even in India, like the Gupta ring, which we have. It gives a slightly bigger midriasis. And most often than not, these are the rings, devices which we use. And BX being the most commonly used, simply because putting it in and getting it out is extremely easy, very, very simple and fast. The only disadvantage with that device is the dilatation is slightly limited. It gives about 5-5.5 millimeter, but that does the job for most scenarios, except in certain situations where you are expecting a weak zonulopathy, something is there, then maybe you want to use a device which gives a bigger dilatation, where the situation is much more complex.
So keeping on this theme with the pseudoexfoliation eye, let's say you have an eye, doesn't dilate, you put in the pupil expansion ring, and you notice that there's some zonulopathy. You try to poke into the lens, enter your lens capsule, you see all the wrinkling. Now what's your move?
Yeah, see, now what I do is, I think I do a little bit things differently here simply because I would like to introduce the CTR early. Usually, the traditionally, it is taught like, you know, hooks go in first and then the CTR goes in last later. So in my way, what I think is many of the cases, if you are able to insert a CTR early enough, you may not be required to use the hooks at all in many situations because the hook itself is going to support it the job. The disadvantage of the hooks is you have to make four or five additional ports and then put it extra. But if the CTR doesn't work, then obviously you have to use the hooks as well. So you need to use four hooks or five hooks depending on that. But it is usually my second resort. First, what I do is I aim for a 5 millimeter axis, do a hydrodissection. Then again, during hydrodissection, we assess the zonular health. When you're trying to decompress the antechamber, the capsular bag, the entire bag is shifting when you're trying to decompress, then it indicates that it's not good enough. CTR has to go in now itself. I don't want to wait until the nucleus management, because maximum amount of zonular trauma, what can happen is during your nucleus maneuvering itself. So I want to stabilize the bag before I do the nucleus management. So that is the logic for me to go ahead and introduce the CTR first. And then again, maybe I'll repeat the hydrodissection and see whether the cortical fibers and it's totally free from the attachment to the bag, because the zonular weakness is going to be exaggerated when you're trying to rotate the nucleus during this nucleus management. Right. I don't want that to happen. So after doing CTR, again, do hydrodissection. Many times, even at that time, it would not leave. You know, the cortex and the bag would not be sticking to each other. You can't really do a cortical cleaving hydrodissection. If in that situations, my hooks go in now, the capsule hooks go in. They go and hook the capsule, and then I do the nucleus management. So this is a little bit different, which I do. So traditionally, the CTR is kept for the
end.
The logic here is, the fear is, okay, there are two fears which most surgeons have. What the cortex aspiration is becomes difficult if you put a CTR early. That's contra point for the CTR early insertion. Second is, what will you do if there's a PC tear? That's another contra point. So there's two counter arguments for early insertion of CTR. So I say that, you know, see, the cortex aspiration is not really such a big deal. So you can always go in and irrigate a little bit more, loosen the cortex and gently do it. My point is, by the time you reach to the cortex aspiration stage, the bag would not be left already because you would have damaged it already. So what is the point? That's my argument. So wait, do it early. And the second point is, what if there is a PCR? So PCR happens, okay, it has happened. Nothing to worry. The CTR will be just in the sulcus. It will just snap and go inside. It's unlikely to go and drop into the vitreous. There's a central PCR. The PC retracts like this. And the CTR will be there in the capsular formices. It will be there most of the times. It's unlikely to go and damage. If it goes down, then obviously we have to remove. But these are the two phobias which make most of the surgeons wait until end to put the CTR inside.
Yeah, I think the common one, people are always worried that if the CTR is going to hold the cortex up against the bag equator, it's going to be so hard to remove cortex.
Yeah, it's not really so difficult to that. Actually speaking, you know, it's not so difficult. You do a little bit of a repeat hydro once the nucleus is come. It just loosens up the cortex, makes it fluffy. And then you have to use a tangential way of stripping. Right. Hold it and then strip it across like this. Then it slides under the ring and comes out. It's not such a difficult thing. The other advantage I'm telling you why to insert CTR early is, many of these eyes, you know, they have the zonular barrier will be not be great. So what happens if the bag is not stretched? There's always a chance of the fluid to get across the zonules into the Burger space, and there's always a positive pressure.
Yes,
bag is not stretched. By putting a CTR inside, you're stretching the bag and you're minimizing the chance of, you know, fluid misdirection happening. It's a very common thing which happens in pseudo exfoliation cases because the zonules are all compromised, the barrier is all compromised. You can see many times there are tiny lens particles in the Burger space, they're indicating that already it has gone inside, there's a fluid misdirection. And that's one of the reasons why pseudo exfoliation cases have got more incidence of PCR, because of the fluid misdirection, the PC comes up, it's become taut, and you're more likely to break it. So by putting in a CTR, you're more likely to stretch the bag across, and the fluid misdirection will happen, but it's at a lesser level. That's what is my take on this, hypothesis on this, I should say.
Yeah, we've all been there before where you're doing this case with a loose honor support, you get the nucleus out, and then you look, there are tiny little particles in front of the anti-haloid phase in Burger space. Absolutely. Behind the nucleus. And then there's so much BSS there that now the bag is shallow. Once the nucleus comes out, your whole bag, your posterior capsules come forward, and the bag is shallow.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no space. The posterior capsule literally will be kissing the cornea, it'll be coming like this.
Right. And those are tough. No, I've had that before where then you have to just put viscoelastic, some yes. cohesive, expand the bag and kind of wait.
Wait, yes. And
wait for it to push some of the...
Yeah, fluid. Waiting is very critical. Absolutely. Don't panic. Put in cohesive and wait. What happens is the fluid which is in the Burger space just flows out like this.
Yeah.
It just flows out like this. I can just wait.
That the hard part for me especially is being patient. You put the you just wait, give it a couple of minutes, which seems like an hour.
Absolutely right.
But yeah, being patient, I think in those cases does help a lot.
Absolutely. And right, you're
right. I'll try that next time. Yeah, I'll try putting a CTR in early. Now, do you try to get like some cortical cleaving hydrodissection first, or do you?
Yeah, there is a small trick here. First, do hydrodissection. And then maybe I will use cortex aspiration. I do the cortex aspiration around that area so that I create some space. And then I inject sodium hyaluronate under the anterior capsule and above the cortex. It's like a small bit of a visco dissection so that you create a space there. And in that space, you can navigate your ring quite easily.
Oh, that's smart. I like that idea. So you put the aspirate a little of the cortex, make a little space, put some viscoelastic to open the space more, and then you can put the CTR in that area.
And there is also this also ensures that the amount of cortex which is going to get entrapped is slightly lesser.
Right, for sure. If you get a nice good you get the correct plane and you get the CTR up against the bag itself and you're not trapping much cortex, make your life much, much easier.
So using the cohesive OVD to create some space will help you.
Right. Oh, that's a great idea. Now, what do you, let's say at the end, you've got a CTR in the bag, you got all the cortex out, now the A is aphakic. What's your choice for lens? Are you just going to put a regular single piece in the bag?
My choice is to put the multi-piece, depending on the zonule. If the zonules are perfectly healthy, everything goes in the bag. But whenever there is, suspicion of zonular weakness, zonular instability, my go-to technique is the three-piece lens, put it in the sulcus and achieve an optic capture. Right. So this, I learned it from Dr. Chang. I saw him perform this many years back in some of the things where he showed that there is a lesser pseudophakodonosis. But I thought this can work in all cases of zonular weakness. So what is the principle is, CTR is going to give the 360 degrees horizontal stretch to the back. It's going to stretch it, and the haptics are going to the sulcus, and the optic is going to be pushed back into the bag under this. So basically, it's like the haptic is like a suspender, which is going to hold the bag. Otherwise, if you put everything in the bag, after 5, 6 years, 10 years, we feel everything goes back into the vitreous. Right. So this is one modification which we are trying, and it is really beneficial. That's what I feel.
Right. David Chang has this famous video where he shows he puts a CTR in the bag. Patient with global zonulopathy, global looseness of everything. And then he puts the 3-piece lens totally in the bag and has the patient move their eye, and the whole thing just shakes. The pseudophakic is terrible. Then he gets the same lens and he brings the haptics up on the sulcus.
Yeah.
The 3-piece lens leaves the optic capture like a button through a buttonhole in behind the anterior capsular axis. Yeah. And then has to move it's totally stable.
Yeah, that's what I learned that from that case probably many years back. I don't remember, but that's what it is. So I learned this technique from him itself. So he proposed it for, it induces lesser pseudophakodonosis.
Yeah.
Lesser. But I feel that it can provide a significant of stability to the bag itself.
Plus, it also makes it makes it less likely to have that late dislocation.
Yeah, that's the idea. The increased stability of the lens.
And then the nice part is too, with a 3-piece lens, it's so easy. If you do get dislocation, it's easy to bring that back.
Yeah, bring the same lens back.
Right. Because I think we're seeing that more now. I've seen these patients who are living longer. They had cataract surgery and they're 75 years old. You see them when they're 90, 15 years later, and the pseudoexfoliation obviously has progressed. And now they've got dislocation of the whole lens, bag, everything. Complex. Yeah.
Very true. Very true.
So, and then unfortunately, in the U.S. here, we don't have some things that you have. We don't have the iris, the retro iris claw lens, which is such a neat idea.
That's great. Yeah, we do a lot here. So those things. It's a very quick procedure. and we are not going through the pass pen or anything, and most anti-segment surgeons can do it very well. So that's one advantage that we have.
Yeah, unfortunately in the US we just don't have that lens available.
Okay.
It's just not FDA approved, and so we don't have that ability. So that's why in the US people are more likely to do things like Yamane or some other scleral sutured lens, which is a lot more work.
Yeah, it's a lot more work, definitely.
And I don't know if it's as quite as stable even. I think that retro iris claw lens really is just a beautiful lens because it's behind, it's in the posterior chambers behind the iris.
Yeah.
Very so stable.
We did have concerns about, you know, the persistent cystoid macular edema with it, and that was a major concern by using the posterior iris claw lens. But many institutes in India are doing this for years, and there's nothing to worry about much, frankly speaking.
Right. Yeah, I think the results look pretty dang good. Quite happy. Now, is there any role for AC-IOLs anymore, anterior chamber lenses, or not really?
No, nowadays we're not using it much. Frankly speaking, the lenses themselves are not to be blamed because I believe that they got a lot of disrepute simply because about the vitreous mismanagement. People did not manage the vitreous well enough initially. So because the complications were predominantly because of the vitreous in the antechamber and everything else. And the blame went on to the antechamber lenses. Mm-hmm. If you've done a very neat vitrectomy and put a antechamber lenses, then they do serve well as well. That's quite my belief. Because at least in my part of the world, you know, the anti-vitrectomy concept was came out very late. Like, you know, we didn't have automated vitrectomy units, and the concept of clearing, having good vitrectomy done before putting any lens it came in late. So that was a time when AC lens were in full vogue, and they earned a lot of disrepute because of that. And I believe that most of the complications were not because of the lens per se, but because of poor management of the complication, that is the vitreous collapse. Mm-hmm.
Well, in fact, that's probably one of the most important things is learning for a young surgeon what to do when the capsule breaks.
Absolutely.
Because undoubtedly it's going to happen.
Absolutely, I think. So in our curriculum, we prepare them for the worst things first. You know, first you should be perfectly knowing how to manage a posterior capsule tear, how do you perform anti-vitrectomy. It's so important because it's doing a neat surgery is all right, but you're not accomplished surgeon until and unless you can manage your own complications. You have to be perfect in managing your own complications. Until and then you don't, there's no need for boasting yourself as a great surgeon. You should be knowing to clean up your own mess.
Right. A young surgeon I was talking to recently at the ASS meeting said that he was very happy that he'd already done in his training 100 phacos and no broken calipers. I said, well, that's great. I'm happy for you, but
yes,
you need to learn how to manage a broken capsule.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's true. Very good.
What are your best pros for a young surgeon? What do you do when the capsule breaks? How do you manage this?
I think the first most important thing is early diagnosis. Most new surgeons fail to diagnose it very early because there is one most important thing is the state of denial. The subconscious mind is telling them there is a PC tear, have a look at it. But the surgeon is telling is in denial mode. There's no PC tear, there's no PC. The rexus has run off. He's refusing to see at it until the nucleus drops.
Yeah.
First, get over the denial mode, okay? Acceptance is the first thing to learn anything new. So the first major complication is not the PC tear, the denial, which is the most important, you know, roadblock which one has to get over it. So this is what causes all the, you know, effects which are worse followed. So I would say that, you know, first diagnose the PC tear early enough. Nowadays, surgeons are lucky enough because they have the microscope with excellent red glow. They can detect the PC tear quite early enough, especially if the nucleus is not there. Otherwise, you know, first train your mind to identify the PC tear early. Then I think you should have a 10-point protocol, something like a 10-point protocol. Whenever you suspect a PC tear, it has to be by-hearted by them. Okay, first what you do if you suspect, don't allow the chamber to shallow, put in OVD, come out, assess the situation. Whether the cortex is there or not, whether the vitreous is prolapsed or not. If vitreous is prolapsed, they should have a different plan. If vitreous is not prolapsed, anti-aloid is still intact, they should have a different game plan. And this plan has to be written down and by-hearted. If somebody is going to wake them up at midnight, 1 o'clock, they should be rattle up all these 10 points just like that.
Right.
Okay, they should have strategies ready. If the PCR is there with the nucleus, what should I do? The PCR is there, no nucleus, what should I do? If the PCR is there, anti-aloid intact, what should I do? If the PCR is there with vitreous lot, what should I do? Imagine all the 4 or 5 scenarios, and they should have the game plan ready. It's like, you know, you should be battle ready before even you encounter your first PCR case. It's not like you do a PCR and then you're wondering and scratching your head, what should I do my next step? No. So you should imagine all the situations that happened to you. Write down 10 points which you're going to do in each scenarios by heart them. So when actually you're faced that situation, you're not overwhelmed by the scenario. Your subconscious mind is already ready to face it. Even you're not done your first vitrectomy, you know what to do it. You know how to manage it. So this is what you need to be trained. You need to be, you can't practice it after a PCR has happened. Practice this in your mind 1,000 times before you encounter first PCR. So imagine all these four, there are four different scenarios. PCR has happened with the nucleus is still there. PCR has happened, the nucleus is gone. And PCR is there, but a vitreous is not disturbed. And PCR with vitreous collapse, everything is there. So these 4 or 5 scenarios, they should have written down a protocol, SOP, a protocol to follow for all these 5 scenarios, and they should be ready. And regarding vitrectomy, I ensure that my fellows practice dry vitrectomy beforehand itself. They should be knowing how the foot pedal work. They should be knowing whether the vitrector is working or not, whether it's cutting, sucking or not. You should be able to know rather than going in there and saying, then my cutter is not working, should know. So do a dry run of this multiple times, and then you're battle ready.
And also maybe have these supplies ready in one place. Some triamcinolone, extraviscoelastic, the disposable vitrectomy probe, the cutter, the infusion cannula. You need to have all these like ready.
Yeah. And have some secret code for stuff, that code red, get all the vitrectomy set ready now.
Yeah. It's helpful. It's important. And yeah, even sometimes if you have a one of these cases where you know it's going to be recombinant, make a list of the steps you want to do and put it on the wall next to the microscope. You just
absolutely. That's also helps. Does help. Absolutely.
Yeah, because I think one of the tough things, as you said, is the denial. It's just such a natural instinct because you don't want bad things to happen. Yeah. So you know it happened, but you just deny it and you keep pressing on.
And then things go worse. You could have saved it from a nucleus being dropped, but because you're in a stage of a denial, nucleus ends up dropping down.
Right. And then another and more important reason why I need to learn to be able to convert to M6.
Absolutely.
You're doing this faker, you have this big nucleus ends in there, capsule's open.
Yeah.
It'd be so nice to just get the whole nucleus out.
Out, yeah. You don't have to go and again refer it to a VR surgeon and a big circus there, you know? So better. So that's one of the reasons that I believe that, you know, every cataract surgeon should be skillful enough to perform an M6 in the current era.
And then obviously you have to be able to complete your case, even with the complication. You got to do a great anterior vitrectomy. That's the catch is, can you do a beautiful anterior vitrectomy?
Yeah. See, if you can manage a PCR with vitreous disturbance well enough, the next day it should be indistinguishable from a routine case, and it is achievable. Okay, right. If you know how to do a good vitrectomy and put the lens in the sulcus with optic capture or even lens in the bag itself, the results will be almost indistinguishable from a routine one. So in the current era, it's much more important because we are doing more toric lenses, we're doing more multifocal lenses. We have to learn to do a vitrectomy without enlarging the PC tear so that the lens can still go ahead in the bag itself. So this era, it's extremely important to how to do a vitrectomy very well. You know, that's extremely important now.
Right. We had a case on cataract coach where a young surgeon inadvertently punctures the posterior capsule of the phaco probe. So you have a very small opening, only the size of the phaco probe. But because of mismanagement, he keeps pulling vitreous forwards, and now the posterior capsule hole becomes like 5 millimeters wide. You pull the vitreous through it, it just expands the hole. And that's just called, you didn't know how to manage it, which is okay, but you got to learn this.
Yeah, that's true.
So I like your way of thinking about just memorizing, okay, what are the possible scenarios? What could go wrong? Yeah. And what will I do at every single step?
So I think, you know, for every surgeon who wants to learn a new technique, my go-to advice would be write down what can go wrong. Okay, mm-hmm. It's a reverse way of thinking. Suppose I want to put a CTR inside the bag. I want to learn a CTR insertion. So write down what can go wrong. What can go wrong? Okay, the CTR itself can jump, and it should be as silly as possible. Every scenario, imagine every scenario. When I'm trying to hold it, it can jump out of my hand and fall outside. When I'm trying to introduce, it can go above the anterior capsule. it can go below the entry, it can go under the capsule and puncture the posterior capsule. And one edge can be above the capsule and one edge can be behind the capsule. Imagine every possible scenario. So if you're prepared well, then your implementation of that act would be much more better and controlled. And even if things go wrong, your mind has already worked it out, how to figure it out and how to work around it. So what can go wrong? This is probably the most important message which I'd like to give, you know, for every new technique which you're learning. Don't learn first, you know, how to hold, how to put this. That's what we try to learn. But rather than that, what can go wrong? If you can address this issue, you write down this, then your mind suddenly figures out, okay, this can, if I do like this, it can go wrong like this. So your mind knows that. See, ignorance is very bad. Most of the times, complications happen because you're ignorant about everything, what can go wrong. So learn everything, what can go wrong. You don't have to do your own mistakes. Learn from other people's mistakes. Write it down, everything. So what can go wrong for every step? If you can master this, you will be master of your surgery.
I love it that way. That's like a thinking man's game. Yeah. So instead of just learning, here are the steps, A, B, C, D. No. Ask yourself, step A, what could go wrong? And step B, what can go wrong?
Yeah,
you think it out. You make surgery into a thinking game.
Yes. I believe surgery is done with the mind, not with the hand. There's a more common misconception that, you know, I have been growing from the childhood, you know, because my father is a surgeon. So the common dinner discussion would be like, you know, that guy has a great surgical hand. This guy had a great surgical hand. It had a lot of turmoil in me, actually. I find, you know, it's quite discouraging when in a resident, anyways, you know, you are judged by your dexterity. You're judged by this, you know.
Yeah.
People say that, you know, either you have it or you don't have it. As a resident, it's a very, very depressing thing. You know, when you're doing, some of your colleagues are learning much more better, quicker than you. Other colleagues might not be learning so quicker than you. And nobody tells you, like, you know, you are either you have it or you don't have it. I believe surgery can be learned and surgery can be taught. There is a way to it. There is a method to it. Some people would take longer time. Some people would take shorter time. But eventually, everybody would go there, get there. Right. The thing is, surgery is done with the mind, not with the hands. That is my message. So think, always think. People have misconception. People say he has got great hands, great hands. I believe the great hands is a result of its great mind. He has been thinking all mind. He's anticipating all those things. Okay. He's anticipating what can go wrong. That's the reason why he has done all the corrective measures. He can anticipate that this case is more likely to develop a PCR. He's sensing that the PC is coming. Something is sensing him. He's experienced enough, intelligent enough to analyze all these things and making corrective measures. But as an observer, we are not seeing all those things. We are just seeing he's got great hands, man.
Mm-hmm.
But we are ignoring the brilliant mind which is there. But this can be taught. That's what I'm trying to tell. This can be taught.
Right.
This can be taught. That's what I'm trying to tell. So I believe that, you know, if you take 100 surgeons, 3% are extremely blessed. Like, you know, blessed. Like, you know, they have got great eyes. They can see 4D, not 3D. They can see 4D. Yeah. They've got super stabilized hands. The 3% of them are 3% are very bad. Like, you know, they may not have stereopsis or something. But remaining 96% who come to the average category, if they can work their mind into right, then they can be propelled into the top 10%.
Yeah,
they can be worked upon. They can be worked upon. That is my objective of what teaching the surgeries. That's my objective. Everybody's in 94%, including me. We are all in the 94%.
Yeah.
If you apply your mind properly, you can push yourself into the top 10%. So analyzing it and thinking it. So surgery is done with the mind, not the hand.
I love that. I'm going to put that as the title for our video here, for our podcast. Surgery is done with the mind, not just the hands.
See, the hand, the dexterity gets a lot of credit. But actually, the mind should get more credit. That's what I feel. And this is a way to motivate some of the younger colleagues who are very depressed. They feel that, you know, they don't have it. People tell either you have it or you don't have it. It's like surgical skill is something like you have it or you don't have it. That's all. It's greater. And the person who feels like, you know, like he doesn't belong there will be very, very depressed. He will be feeling miserable. He's branded that he's going to be not a surgeon. He's going to be a non-surgeon. So my goal is to maybe pull them a little bit too and push them out here.
Fantastic. Well, I cannot believe we've been talking for an hour already. Can you imagine? Wow, look at the time flies and you're having fun. I want to thank you so much for doing this podcast. Please send me your massage video. We're going to definitely share that with the world. We'll definitely put a link to your YouTube channel below. I'm a huge fan. I subscribe to your YouTube channel. I love it.
Thank you for doing our podcast. You're very kind. Thank you so much for having me here. And great. It was great talking to you.
Thank you, my friend. And remember, our viewers and listeners, I got a new Cataract Coach podcast every single Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere where you find your podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, we also now have a Retina Rounds podcast. And of course, a new Cataract Coach video every single day and a new Retina Rounds video every single day. So until next time, I'll catch you later.